troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast, brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here again. Kevin, what's going on this lovely afternoon?
Basically, the world is burning and everything's going crazy. So other than that, everything's great.
All right, let's talk about science. Anyways, well, our condolences to everyone who's out there dealing with the hard stuff. We're going to leave it at that instead of diving into anything political, but... Anyways,
it changes so much every day that if this is published a few days later, then all the news from a few days before is obsolete. It changes every day now. And that's why covering science topics is so difficult, because even science is moving at breakneck pace. So we're lucky to be able to do this.
Yeah, very true. Although I think we've got some good topics that are developing relatively slowly, so we can at least introduce people to them. So that's an exciting thing, I say. But let's get into it. So first up, diabetes kills about 100,000 Americans a year. So we're going to look at a few groundbreaking ways biotechnology may help prevent these unnecessary deaths. And we all know the importance of self-control, but how and why did this important skill develop? A new study offers an interesting explanation for the evolution of self-control. Next, most medicines are made in the lab, but could we grow them in genetically engineered plants? The answer appears to be yes, and doing so offers a lot of potential benefits. And finally, Greenpeace wants to ban pesticides that can prevent cancer. I'm just going to let that sink in for a few minutes, and then we'll dive into the details in a little while. But first up, Kevin, let's talk about this article by John Cumbers.
Yeah, so the article is basically deals with potential remedies for diabetes. And diabetes is a big deal. You're looking at something like 40 million Americans now, and estimated almost 55 million by the year 2030. And this is type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is where your body doesn't make insulin, and type 2 is where your body fails to respond to insulin. So type 2 is the one that is a little bit more challenging, because it's acquired for different reasons. And people develop this usually as a later onset type of disease, even though you're seeing it more and more in kids now. And it has a lot to do with sugar. And it's a insensitivity, a metabolic disorder, insensitivity to sugar based upon its major consumption. So the big trick now is, how do we get beyond the problem of diabetes? How can we help solve this outside of drugs, drug regimens, and insulin-based therapies? And what they talk about is the innovation that's been happening in a couple spaces, both in monitoring, microbiome, and in sugar alternatives. The biomonitoring has been a real playground for biohackers. People who are trying to come up with ways to identify mechanisms of continuous glucose monitoring. So having a device that's always on you, like your Fitbit watch, instead of counting your steps, it counts your glucose. And this way you're able to report how you have excursions in blood sugar throughout the day and night that may or may not coincide with eating or other behaviors. So that's looking like a major step forward, at least in terms of being able to monitor how your blood sugar behaves. And that's a big part. Awareness is the first step.
Now, since he mentions biohacking, or I think it's sometimes called do-it-yourself biology, do you see any real solutions to this problem coming from, you know, people working in their garage, or, you know, just working on their own on this? Or is it going to come from even a more established startup, or even a bigger biotech firm? Just for people who aren't familiar with this space at all, what do you think about
that? Well, the big companies have already done this in a very big way. You can now have an implanted device that you can hold up to your smartphone that will tell you what your blood glucose is. And other ones are monitoring on a more continual basis. I would almost bet that within 5 years, this will be an implantable type of technology that we'll all have. And it'll monitor your heart rate, your blood oxygen saturation, your glucose, maybe alcohol level, you know, could be. There's a lot of things. Sure. You know, tie it to your ignition, right? And if you did this, it would give a real-time idea of what your blood sugar is like. And I come from a family history of crazy blood sugar excursions and crash after I eat. You know, this is something that I think would be really cool.
Well, without a doubt, and there's still a lot of room for growth, I should say, because this is according to the NIH. They say that this continuous glucose monitoring, it's not even available for type 2 diabetics yet. And the results in most cases still have to be validated with a finger prick test. And so there's a ton of room for growth. And so why do you say 5 years? You think it could really develop that quickly?
Oh, I'm sure it's already been done. And when you look at what's being done in hospitals where they monitor through telemetry and all the, you know, ways that they monitor your vitals, this is something that I'm certain would be implantable or capable of being implanted and working in concert with a smartwatch or smartphone. Associated software. You know, people would freak out by something like this in some ways, but in a way, it's information I would love to know. So, you know, something that a geek like me would dive on in a heartbeat.
Well, you see, Bill Gates is going to use it to take over the world and control our minds. So, I'm just reporting the facts, Kevin. You know.
Other ways that this is being done. They mentioned in the article. Some stuff that's come from a company called Day 2. It's done by Lehi Siegel in Israel. And this is a Israeli company that, based on a couple of papers, very, very interesting stuff, they noticed that some people who were morbidly obese could eat anything they wanted, never had any weird blood sugar problems. Other people who appeared to be in very good health would have crazy blood sugar excursions in response to food. And they tested a lot of things about them and found out that one of the major drivers of congruence within those two populations were microbiome correlates. So the presence of specific populations of microbiome, of a bacteria in your microbiome. And so this whole company talks about its roles in potentially having effects on type 2 diabetes. You mail a deuce off to Israel, you know, and then a couple of weeks later you get your data back, and it costs like $300. I looked into this a couple of years ago when I first learned about it because it seems pretty legit, and they give you a prescription for your diet based upon your microbiome. And it's got all the red flags of woo and weirdness. But when you look at the corresponding data, it looks like there's some good science behind it. I tend to think this might be a really interesting one.
Well, without a doubt. And the trend seems to be the technology is in its infant stages, and then people try to capitalize on it too soon, and they make unsubstantiated claims. And then the science catches up within a few years or a decade. And then, you know, it's a more realistic presentation of what those initial companies were offering becomes, you know, legitimate medical treatment. Would you agree with that? Is that kind of the trend line, would you say?
Right. Well, it's all there's a gap to be filled, right? And so what typically happens is that scientists or companies, small companies, universities, whatever, everybody goes to fill that gap, and some overshoot it, some oversell it. Some don't quite hit it right, but it's an evolution and it's a marathon rather than a sprint. And someone wins the marathon, right? But you may not be the one who's in the lead after the first or 13th mile. So all of this is good, in my opinion, and really neat stuff coming. The other big place is in new artificial sweeteners. And where the article mentions that even things like aspartame and the normal sweeteners, they have effects that still do trigger changes in blood chemistry for unknown reasons. But there's a lot of new ones that are coming, and they're all based on steviacides. And steviacides are the molecules that are produced in the plant stevia. It's a natural kind of sweetener that in and of itself has a slightly bitter finish. I don't know if you ever tried stevia, but it's good, but it's got a little room to improve. And now for maybe 5, maybe 10 years, different companies have tried using genetic engineering to decorate this very complex molecule in ways that would give it better shelf life, better stability in the food compounds, and remove that bitterness. And there's a whole suite of products that are coming from synthetic biology that are just like that. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, well, we've talked about this before. I think this might be one of the best examples yet of biotechnology just making practical improvements to life for people. And I'm sure you know some diabetics, Kevin, but my father-in-law is a diabetic and it really impacts his quality of life. You know, if we go out to dinner or something, he's got to shoot himself up before he can have food. And, you know, it just impacts all kinds of aspects of his life. And so these are great examples of science making life better.
Oh yeah. My whole family is diabetic. It ultimately was the thing that contributed to my mom's death with, you know, a lot of overlaying complications. You know, when you're diabetic and you're in the hospital, it makes everything more difficult because of healing time and everything. So by really focusing on diabetes, we help alleviate a lot of the pressure on many different aspects of the healthcare process. And with so many people diabetic, investing a lot of interest in this particular area is really important.
Yep. Well, I'm very excited to see where this goes, but let's move on and talk about the evolution of self-control. I thought this was a pretty cool study that this article is about. So introduce us to this.
Yeah. So the idea of self-control. So like many diabetics don't have self-control when going to walk by a plate of Girl Scout cookies. It ties in with this. Okay. So that the article was really cool because it talks like early hominids, how they could start to craft different kinds of tools. And even about 2 million years ago, so we weren't really humans yet, not really Homo sapiens, but hominids began to create at least very elaborate, carefully designed tools that were being crafted for specific applications. And University of York scientist Dr. Penny Spikens, she says that the tools were really occurring about the time that brain expansion was also occurring. And that when you look at the ability of tool making, the process of tool making, it was really talking about the process of self-control. That here were people who were deliberately foregoing other fun things of caveman life, like, you know, whatever, to sit down and start, you know, with a blank slate, essentially, probably a piece of slate. I'm walking right into them too. I didn't write these down ahead of time. Walking into the opportunity to craft a tool for something they would use. So obviously they recognized a need and then they went to fill it. Kind of like we talked about before, that they're actually creating something very deliberately through what is a relatively painstaking task of cracking rock to develop some sort of a tool.
Yeah, it's very cool stuff. And one thing I liked about the study design, or I don't even know if you call it a study since it's archaeology, but whatever the case, I remember seeing a PBS documentary a few years ago, and they were trying to explain from an evolutionary perspective why humans developed a fascination with gold. And the best answer they could come up with was, well, it's shiny. And when we were evolving and we needed to find a water source, it would reflect sunlight. And so it was shiny. And therefore, we also like gold. And, you know, that's ridiculous. And in my opinion, because it's just a just so story. And I know that's a common criticism of evolutionary psychology and biology. But I think they avoided that by saying, well, look, here's this specific thing they were working on, and here's what went into it. And here's the, I think it was 5 factors that relate to self-control that we think we're evolving. So I think all that to say, this is an interesting approach to trying to validate the explanation that they're putting forward.
Yeah, and all of that is really, really important in understanding the social connections between humans, because so much of what civilization became with was rooted in the ability of individuals to be able to take on specific tasks within that larger framework. And really, that was an important step in human evolution, was this idea of cooperation that was rooted in self-control. And from that differentiation of jobs, differentiation of duties, and all of this was a big part in how humans evolved.
So overall, just before we move on, as a biologist, would you say this is a reasonable explanation for what they are trying to describe here? It avoids that sort of that tautological criticism of these kind of theories.
Well, sure, it's a good hypothesis to test, right? And I think that's we're trying to make predictions about what happened 500,000, to 2 million years ago based on archaeological evidence. And that's always very challenging to do. It's the ultimate, Sherlock Holmes investigation. And, I always thought I'd love to do this when I was a kid, and I got an A in my archaeology class in college. But the idea was that you're assembling an interpretation from the data that are presented. And it's what every scientist does. Here you're just looking at things that happened a long time ago and assembling a interpretation from here's the evidence in situ that happened.
Right. Well, let's move on to something that's not as limited by history, I guess we could say. And let's talk about turning plants into drug factories. And I believe this is an article by one of your grad students, Kevin. Is that right?
And that's what was so funny about this. I started reading it and I'm going, this is really good. And then I started thinking, I've read this somewhere before. So this is work by Telfidus Schwepes. Telfidus is a really good guy. He's a graduate student in my laboratory who is about to complete his PhD. He's been a very active writer and excited to contribute to the public understanding of science. And in this article, he talks about the idea of how plants are being used to assist in the process of creating specific kinds of drugs. And it all boils down to the idea that we can manufacture synthetic compounds like aspirin and ibuprofen and all that good stuff. But other compounds have to be made in biological contexts. So right now there's something like 200 FDA-approved biologicals, biologic drugs. And even though it's only a small part of the population, a couple percent that use them, it's something like 40% of spending on drugs, because these are extremely expensive to produce. And usually they're produced in bacteria or fungi or animal cell culture, something like that, and then purified. And in this case, plants offer advantages to those other kinds of systems. So this is why these are so interesting.
So talk a little bit about how an approach like this could make production cheaper and faster, and by extension, less expensive for consumers. And it's going to get medicine to people quicker whose lives are very potentially on the line.
Yeah, and this is a big deal because a lot of these drugs are targeting things like cancer. There are monoclonal antibodies. There are all kinds of other interesting proteins that you can't necessarily deliver orally, that you have to get injections. And there's a huge part of the population that just fears the needle, that in there too. But what this means is that instead of growing fungus or bacteria that's genetically engineered in a giant bioreactor and then pulling that out and purifying it, in plants, you can just have a bigger greenhouse. You have a greenhouse space instead of a bioreactor. You don't need culture media. You just grow them in soil or whatever you grow them in. Plants don't support human pathogens. So in other words, you can purify it from plants. And if something else comes along, some other infectious agent for a plant, who cares? You're not going to get a bad case of tobacco mosaic virus, you're not going to get like leaf wilt or anything. So the idea is that there's a lot of good examples. And the other part of this is that in some cases, you can take plant material that's overexpressing a given protein or biological entity, medicine, and grind it up and put it in a capsule that's got some resilience in the digestive system. And between the capsule and the cell walls of the plant, which are a little bit slow to digest, you can actually get good delivery and bioavailability through the intestine. So this way, you're almost using the plant as another shield to ensure that this drug is being delivered to where it'll be maximally absorbed. And so that's the other really big advantage of using plants.
And this isn't just theoretical. We talked a few weeks ago, or maybe over a month now, about the vaccine for coronavirus that Medicago is developing, which is being grown in tobacco plants. So that's a huge example. And then he gives the example in the article of growing insulin-like growth factor in lettuce. And I don't think it's been tested with humans yet, but they've fed it to mice and it's had the desired effect. So talk a little bit about how this is already being applied and how it could be applied in the near future, Kevin.
Well, the big thing is that the idea of plant-based vaccines and what they call plantibodies, this is nothing new. People have been talking about this for 20 years and it works and it's doable. The problem is that it's just not cost-effective yet. That the idea of still injecting a virus into eggs, like chicken eggs, and developing it there, culturing it there, is still more cost-effective than doing it in plants. But I think that is shifting. And Medicago has done a fantastic job of this. They're a really wonderful company, and I think they're doing great work. And they've actually SARS-CoV-2, you know, the COVID-19 vaccine. They made it, that was one of our first podcasts. They were able to create that within 10 days of having the DNA sequence. So the other nice thing is it gives us a very fast way to produce a huge amount in a very short time. And so that's another big part of this kind of activity.
And one of the, I think probably the most important thing that he mentions in the story is that if you have a vaccine that you can put into, say, a tomato or some other food source, you can ship it all around the world and get it to people who need vaccines, who maybe don't have electricity and refrigeration, and they don't have all of the proper technology to administer standard vaccines that we give through shots here in the United States. And so, I mean, this could have an enormous impact in some of these developing countries in Africa and East Asia where people are dying from preventable diseases.
Well, think about that for a minute, is that you have places in the world where you're now sending in teams of health workers into hostile places like Yemen or even areas in Pakistan where they're very, very suspicious of Western medicine. And you wouldn't have to send in people. You could send in seeds and people could grow that stuff, and eat the plants or eat the plant materials and it's done. And frankly, I'd rather have a BLT than go get a tetanus shot, you know. But this is the beauty of this. If you can distribute these materials through genetically engineered seeds, you now give a possibility for people to grow their medicine. And I think it was Hippocrates who said, or Aristotle, let the food be your medicine. And this is a case where that may really be what's happening.
Yeah, I am. I'm super excited to see where this goes. I'm, of course, for the public health benefit, but I'm curious to see how the anti-vax people will respond. I'm curious to see how consumers will respond to this as it becomes available. So we'll have to monitor that for sure. But let's go on to probably our most frustrating story, I'd say, and talk about Greenpeace lobbying the European Union to ban what are relatively safe fungicides. And Kevin, you can elaborate, but the big deal is that these can help prevent cases of cancer, and they're trying to stop the use of these. So what are they all upset about?
Yeah. So in the next frontier of chemophobia, Greenpeace has been at this one for a few years, and it's only really starting to gain traction. And before we can understand how egregious this is, we really have to understand what mycotoxins are. So mycotoxins are a type of, they're toxins that come from fungi that infect plants. And the ones that really steal the show are called aflatoxins from Aspergillus flavus, aflatoxin. Some other ones like vomitoxin, which appropriately named. I wonder how that happened, you know. All of these are occur because of contaminated food, and usually food that has too much moisture or damaged food products are susceptible. So insect damage on a crop can be an ingress for a fungal pathogen. And what's worse is that animals that consume aflatoxin-laden food products then can pass that in milk and meat. So aflatoxins are a very serious thing. They're so serious that in the Western world, in the U.S., we monitor grain production to ensure that aflatoxin levels are low. And I can't remember the threshold that we accept, but it is really, really low. It's in the low parts per billion. So in the order of, if it's over a few seconds in 32 years, you know, worth one part per billion being a second in 32 years. If it's a few seconds in 32 years, that whole load is rejected. So we really watch for this.
And just to give people a little more information so you understand the scale of this, this is a quote, and this is Bill Wirtz writing in Your Active, by the way, but he says, up to 28% of all liver cancer can be attributed to aflatoxins, and its immunosuppressant features leave humans weakened against other diseases. And then in Africa, it's 40% of all liver cancers. I mean, so this quite literally is killing people around the world. And you have this activist group trying to block the most practical tool. Maybe not the most practical, one of two very practical tools. So talk about the fungicides, Kevin. These are called SDHI fungicides, I believe. What do they do, and are they safe?
Well, SDHIs are one type of fungicide. Fungicides are pretty cool because they target specific aspects of fungal metabolism. So the major classes of fungicides typically are what are called ergosterol inhibitors. I think we talked about this on the podcast before, where humans make cholesterol, they make ergosterol. So if you can break that, you know, that's one way to do it. SDHIs are what are called succinate dehydrogenase inhibitors. And there's a whole class of them. I don't know. Let me see if I can. Bisophen, Boscalid, Penflufen. All of them have names like tools left at the Three Stooges. You know, Flutolinil, you know. But there's a whole series of them. And what they do is they specifically inhibit fungal respiration or electron transport in energy production in a fungus. So, we can go into the whole thing. It's an inhibition of blocking what are called ubiquinone binding sites in the mitochondrial complex too. It's a whole thing that biochemically essentially interrupts electron transport and energy production in fungus. So they have very low capacity to cause effects in non-fungal organisms. So no effects on plants, no effects on humans or other animals. So they're really cool in their specificity.
And I believe they're so safe that French regulators told these activist groups to go kick rocks because they tried to get they tried to get France to ban these. And even their pesticide safety officials, who are very conservative and I would say probably too conservative in many cases, even they looked at the data on this and they said, well, this is just baseless. We're not banning these, you know, to give you some perspective on the claim that Greenpeace is making. So can you comment on that aspect at all?
Well, that's the truth though. I mean, the French regulators have looked at the data and said, this is safe stuff. And the idea is that if you can turn France, you can start on the EU. And Greenpeace, on their rhetoric and over the years, and this goes back in, I don't know, maybe even the early 2012, 13, they've always, if you go back on their website, and I haven't seen anything there in a long time, but I always remember them talking about fungicides as pesticides. And they are pesticides. But they're one class of pesticides, which include herbicides, insecticides, fungicides, antimicrobials. They always talk about them in the as bee harming and dangerous to bees, and but they're not. They're fungicides, and yet all of the rhetoric around this from Greenpeace is very just anti-agriculture. They go after fertilizers. They go after any kind of farm input. And they say it puts nature, puts our health at risk, all this kind of thing. This is what they do. The good reason, the good news is when you look at how often Greenpeace is shared or retweeted, or, you know, their stories are, you know, shared in other media, every year it is less and less, and people just don't care. And what's really cool about this story is that the French authorities, the European food safety folks, they basically said, you know, get out of here. You know, we're not going to buy into this, which goes back to be a huge score for French farmers and others, because I think it said in this article, I don't remember the exact statistic, but some substantial portion of the European produced grain is above the thresholds or the limits for mycotoxins. And so we need to have more fungicide, not less, and safe, correct use of fungicides to target the pathogens when they can lead to mycotoxin production.
You know, one thing I found interesting about this is that, and maybe I'm off base, so correct me if I'm wrong, but in Europe, you have real hostility to genetic engineering and to many pesticides. But the moment that it gets to the point where people sense their health is really in jeopardy, all of a sudden they become experts at analyzing risk and they realize, oh, you know, this could really harm us. And so we're not going to go along with these people. Do you think there's anything to that, that once you put your own health on the line, it's no longer just an abstract issue where you get to virtue signal about how much you care about the environment and, you know, that all goes out the window because you're like, well, I don't want liver cancer.
Well, that's absolutely the case. I think you see people have a very strong change of heart when the chips are down. And you see people who, the biggest example is in, what do they call it? Complementary medicine, right? And you see the example of, well, I'm just going to treat my cancer myself until it doesn't work, and then you go for very aggressive treatments because the original thing failed. And, you know, this is a big thing you frequently, I guess the best reports come from celebrities who decided to treat themselves, you know, Suzanne Summers or whatever. You know, these folks do this, it doesn't work, and then have to go for radical expensive therapy to correct the problem they could have solved at its very early stage, if they can correct it at all. And those are the real tragedies, the people who end up dying from a disease that could have been treated if it was caught and treated earlier.
Yeah. And I'm going to put a link on the show page for this, but there's an agricultural economist named Stuart Smythe who's done some great research on this. And he wrote an article for GLP where he documented how introducing GMO BT crops into, I believe it was India. I don't know exactly which country. It was probably India. But he documents how that lowered the mycotoxin levels in corn and ended up lowering the number of cancer cases that they had. And he details all the data so you can go through that. But all that to say, this has a real impact. And Greenpeace, of course, is also opposed to all genetic engineering. So the two solutions, those are the things I was referring to earlier, they're opposed to both. And so we're sort of just left throwing our hands up if they get their way, which is just not acceptable to me. Because human life is the most important thing. You know, it's not the environment, although that is important, but saving lives takes precedent.
Well, you wouldn't be throwing your hands up in the air. You'd be throwing them around the shaft of a short hoe and going out to remove weeds. Because if Greenpeace had their way, it would be everyone doing what they call agroecological farming, which means most of the country, at least in the U.S., would be shut down for most of the year. And you'd be dependent upon what you and your family could go produce during the few months you could produce it, investing huge amounts of time in combating pests and disease, and then canning what you could can and hoping you don't starve during the winter. You know, I don't understand where they come from. You know, we live at a time where we should be celebrating the incredible bounty of food we have. and instead trying to fight against a system that creates it for us seems really counterproductive.
We'll have to do an episode on this. I forget what exactly the concept's called, but a lot of these groups are motivated by this idea that humans are just one part of nature, you know, and we have a specific role to play and we don't own the land, you know, all those things. And so I think maybe that's why people are so confused by them, is that they're talking past each other. Because people like you and me say, well, this technology can help save lives. And that doesn't matter to them, because it's just like ideologically they're coming from a different place. So maybe we can dive into that one day. But and it's not a conspiracy. I mean, it's as far as they're concerned, it's a legitimate idea. And so I think that's important for people to understand. It's wrong nonetheless. And I think in many cases you could make a case that it's evil. But, you know, that's where they're coming from. So,
well, I spent the last 35 years of my life, and it really makes people angry when I say it, but we spent, ever since we started making tools out of stone and showing our self-control, we've been beating back nature, and we've been trying to, the natural order that's trying to eliminate us for the planet. And we've been doing everything we can to have medicine and better technology and more food and doing everything we can to sustain more people, save more lives, working against nature's entropy in order to make people more sustainable. And I think that we have to be really careful when we ask to turn the clock backwards to more ancient technologies, because I don't know that we'll be able to take care of people as we should. And I think that, like you say, that should be our first priority.
There's your fortune cookie, everybody. Kevin Folta dropping some wisdom. All right. Well, I guess we're going to leave it there. Kevin, why don't you tell us about Talking Biotech for this coming week?
Well, the one that just came out is really an interesting one, because it's me answering your questions. We haven't done that in a long time. But we're rapidly moving into what will be 5 complete years, starting in the second week of June. So kind of planning to try to do some big stuff there and looking for some big interviews and working hard to continue the coverage of COVID-19, especially with some of the biggest experts out there. So working on that and trying to get some good content for you to enjoy there as well.
Absolutely. So check out Talking Biotech. I do every week. I'm a better person for it. I feel edified after I, but check it out. So it's talkingbiotechpodcast.com, right?
That's right. And okay. Yeah, perfect.
And then we are at geneticliteracyproject.org. We're on Spotify. We're on iTunes. Subscribe and write reviews. I think I saw a few this week. So thank you guys for listening. Woo-hoo. And writing reviews and checking out the podcast, because we're getting a lot of listeners. So thank you guys very much. And I am at Cam J English on Twitter. Kevin, you are at Kevin Folta.
That's right.
My memory is on fire. Anyways, so we're going to leave it there. Thank you guys so much. And we will see you next week.